Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris and you're watching Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. The 26th UN or United Nations Climate Change Conference of Parties, or COP26 as it's better known, took place in Glasgow from the 31st of October until the 13th of November, and it saw 2 weeks of intense negotiations to ensure global action to deal with the climate emergency. So what was the outcome? Did we see progress, or and where did we see continued resistance? Our guest today is Meenakshi Raman, or more affectionately known in social activism circles as Meena Raman. She's the president of Sabah Alam Malaysia and the head of programs for Third World Network. Meena has been practicing public interest law for almost 30 years now. She's represented grassroots communities taking on big corporations in Malaysia. She was in Glasgow for the conference, and let's find out from her what went down there and also have her help us decode some of the language that came out in the COP26 agreement. Meena, good evening. Thank you so much for being on the show today. Now, if I may begin our conversation today, Meena, by perhaps having you paint us a picture of, you know, what went on in COP26, because we're watching from the outside. And I'm just wondering, I mean, what happens at these conferences, at these negotiations? I'm thinking that, you know, all parties come to the table in good faith. They come there with the same intention of achieving action against the climate emergency. But is that really the case? Is it a level playing field?
It's certainly not a level playing field at all, Melissa. I think this is the 26th COP, as you know, and we've moved very, very slowly. And I think COP26, actually, I call it a charade of keeping, you know, limiting temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. You know, the Western world, they are really, you know, you have the same old negotiators, they don't change. And then you have huge think tanks supporting them. Like the US will have lots of lawyers, you know, in their team and so on. And, you know, many of our delegations from the developing world, they come with very small delegations. They don't have the negotiating history. And there's constant changes. So they don't even know how the Paris Agreement came to be. So it's not level. I mean, the playing field is really unlevel. And also, since it's a UK COP, the presidency of the UK oversaw the COP. A lot of things happen behind the scenes, and the UK is part of the, well, they are out of the EU, but they worked very closely with the EU. They work very closely with a lot of the Western governments. So from the get-go, I think if you recall, the previous COP was actually in Madrid in Spain. That was actually hosted by Chile. And because they had problems in Chile, it was hosted in Spain. But 2 years in a row, the UK presidency has been involved, because we did not have a COP last year because of the pandemic, but they were the incoming presidency. So what you had the UK do actually with all its ambassadors and all its might, go to all the countries around the world, try to pressure, try to push. They had this net zero by 2050 pledge for everyone to do. So this was going around behind the scenes. They came to all the capitals. They came to Kuala Lumpur. They came to many, many countries. They particularly a lot in India and also to China and so on. So it was really a big pressure that comes from behind the scenes. And even right at the COP itself, you have Boris Johnson calling, you know, capitals. You have even John Kerry reaching out and all that. So I actually think that the playing field is not level at all.
Okay, so how important, Meena, are, you know, you said, you talked about the size of delegations, the presence there, you know, the big guns are present at COP. Right up to the head of state, you know, presidents and prime ministers helping to negotiate. How important is the size and the heft of the delegation? And I'm just wondering, because could you give us some context as to Malaysia's role, Malaysia's size and heft at the negotiating table at COP26?
Well, I'm not sure how many people went from Malaysia, but you cannot negotiate alone. You have to be in alliances. That's what normally happens at the COPs. So you have the largest group of negotiating bloc for developing countries called the Group of 77 and China. It's not 77 countries, but it, you know, it was history, but it really have about 100 plus developing countries under its rubric. But then there are subgroups of the G77, because they're not always united. Usually the developing countries come together on issues of finance, on issues of technology transfer and so on. But on the issue of mitigation, which is about emissions reductions, they're usually divided. Because you have the small islands, for instance, it's called the Alliance of Small Island States. You have the least developed countries who do not have the same kind of obligations as the other developing countries. So in the convention and under the Paris Agreement at COPs, the developing countries all come under developing countries. But then within the developing countries, there are various groups of developing countries. And the focus always has been by the Western world, particularly on those in the G20. But the G20 terminology is not used in the convention at the COP. But what the developed world tried to do was actually to bring in terms like G20, which means it would have focused on India, China, Indonesia, you know, all the what they would call big emitters. I mean, China and India are known as the big emitters. But if you look at them in terms of absolute emissions, they are actually big. But if you look in terms of the per capita, that means by population, their emissions are large because of population. I mean, between India and China, you have half the population of the world.
Half the world, yes.
You know? Yeah, half the world in there. And you can't put them on the same platform as countries like the United States or the European Union and so on, because they are historical emitters. And it's recognized now, even in the latest science, that much of the global warming that we see today is the result of historical, past and historical cumulative emissions, as they call it. So they look at it from 1850 onwards. So if you look at those emissions, and CO2, carbon dioxide, is one of the greenhouse gases, remains in the atmosphere for a very long time. So that is really responsible for much of the global warming today. And so the Western world, with only 18% of the population, has been emitting something like about 60% of the emissions over the years, over history. And they've become rich because they become wealthy because of, you know, you're not constrained. They were pumping, you know, oil and coal, and they were relying on all this. And because of that, they became very wealthy. And today, I mean, since the time the Framework Convention was negotiated in 1992, from, you know, 1992 was the Earth Summit, Rio. It was the daughter of the Rio Summit. And since then, there was a recognition that there's a common but differentiated responsibility between the developed and the developing countries. And that's really important. But the Western world, they tried to do this ever since in Paris, and also in COP26, was very obvious. They did not want any reference to historical responsibility. So they say that, oh, we didn't know. When we were emitting our greenhouse gases at that time, and we were dependent on coal, we had no idea that coal is going to cause problems. But what we ask is, when did you know? Of course, since the 1970s already, and even before, everybody knew that the fossil fuel emissions were causing, a problem, the greenhouse effect. And so to say that you don't know is no excuse. And that is the problem, because they are diluting this very important principle we call equity principle. Equity meaning the rich and the poor are not at the same level. The rich world has to actually pay, or what we call, owe a climate debt to the developing world. And the poor would have a longer transition. So that means when you talk about emission reductions, we cannot start from the same platform. So it's the developed world must take the lead. And this is where the problem is. They were shifting their responsibility to the developing world.
Mina, I want to come back to this common but differentiated responsibility. And I think it's important to make that difference of the responsibility and accountability of the developing world, particularly at global climate talks like COP. But you mentioned India and China, and I just want to focus on all the coverage that was focused on what happened with India and China. And you also talked about coal. So for the first time at a COP conference, there was an explicit plan to reduce the use of coal, right? But then there was this brouhaha over the commitment to phase out or phase down coal. So can we talk a little bit about that? What actually happened? You were there, so what did you see?
Well, just to give you the context of the coal discussion, this already, this whole issue of coal and coal phase out was actually in the G20. There was a big pressure by the developed world to focus on coal. And why coal? Because they are already phasing out of coal. But just to set the context, even Germany today has not phased out coal. It's the most supposed to be the most climate friendly. It hasn't phased out coal. They did not focus on all fossil fuels. The language there is about phase out of fossil fuel subsidies. Subsidies is different from actually phasing out of fossil fuels. So why the rich world only focus on coal? Because India and China were depending big dependers of coal. So even India was pushing for fossil fuel phase out. So the other side said no. So it wasn't about fossil fuels, it wasn't about oil, it wasn't about gas, it was only about coal. So they pretended as if this was a big deal. So they called out on all countries. It's not a commitment, it's a calling out. There's a difference in the way the language is used. So it calls out. The initial text was about a phase out of coal, but then they have the word called unabated coal. So it's not all coal, it's unabated coal. And what's the meaning of unabated coal? Yeah, you can go on for a long time to discuss what is abated and unabated. and I assume it's my speculation, I guess, it's about no use of carbon capture and storage. That means what's called a technology where when you emit, you sequester that carbon. So unabated coal. And then they talk about the phase out of inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. Again, what is efficient, what is inefficient? So you can go on for the next few years fighting over what's that. But anyway, the point of the matter is that because there was no recognition of the principle of common but differentiated responsibility between developed and developing countries, the language was calls on parties. So it did not make a difference between the rich and poor. And so it went on to say all parties. So of course, India, rightly so, said no. Since you do not recognize the CBDR or the Common but Differentiated Responsibility, it introduced language in the final hours to say, with taking into account targeted support for the poorest and the vulnerable. That is to actually help populations in the poor in the developing world where there is still a lot of energy poverty. They don't have energy. And if you depend on coal like in India and there are millions of people in the villages who do not have any access to energy at all. So instead of talking about just renewable energy, you have to recognize that they have no energy at all. So this is why it's very important to ensure that there's a transition, that is a just transition, so that you actually deliver energy. And of course, the cleaner it is, the better it is, but that takes a while. If the rich world until today takes a long time to even phase out of fossil fuels, to say that all countries have to do it at the same time, that was really unjust. So that's why India and supported by China came up with that language. And I think it is right because it is about targeting the poor.
Well, this is an interesting context. Thank you for providing that because, if you just read the headlines, it paints a very different picture. It paints a picture of China and India refusing to commit or refusing to address, a reduction in terms of coal use. Mina, we're going to take a quick break, but again, there's still so much to cover. So let's come back and continue our conversation. Stay tuned to Consider This. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. Let's continue our conversation with Mina Rahman, President of Sabah Alam Malaysia, about what happened at COP26 in Glasgow and what's next for global climate policy, as well as what's next for Malaysia when it comes to addressing the climate crisis. Can we talk a little bit, Mina, about some of the challenges when it came to negotiating between developed nations and developing the developing countries? You talked about how, there is the common but differentiated responsibility, and part of that responsibility has to do with with, you know, funds, with monies, with, you know, paying for the accumulated emissions and helping developing countries deal with their efforts to combat climate change. Was there progress on that front when it comes to finance of climate action?
Pathetically and regrettably, it was most disappointing. It was outrageous, to say the least. Because for those who don't know, already in 2009, there was a promise by the developed world that they would mobilize per year $100 billion per year by 2020. That never got realized. At best, in public finance, we only have about 20 to 25 billion mobilized. Of course, the developed world counted all kinds of things, including loans, you know, which were not even concessional as climate finance, and they escalate the figure. But by all accounts, everybody agreed, including them, they did not meet their 100 billion per year goal by 2020. So they came to COP26 and they were supposed to have a real milestone on how they're going to deliver. They already were saying that we're going to be only realizing this in 2025, by 2025. So there's another 5-year delay. When they came to COP26, they said, okay, we will do this by 2022. Still, they're all about promises. No clear roadmap, no actual plan on how this is going to be delivered and whether it's going to be grants, whether it's going to be loans. And for developing countries, particularly coming out of a pandemic, many of our countries were suffering, even including our own country, a lot of resources and national budgets going into economic recovery because of the COVID response. But, you know, and then on top of it, we have a climate challenge. So they, we're dealing with multiple crises. And for many of the developing countries, they were already in rising indebtedness. There are a lot of debt accumulating, but they were borrowing to prop up their economies. So this finance was actually very important. But the, you know, the whole focus was on India and China. For me, it was a deflection from the real inaction that came from the developed world. So they were really very obstinate and they were resistant to strong language on the mobilization of that goal, on the provision of that 100 billion goal. And there was also this new goal that under the Paris Agreement that they are supposed to agree to. Developing countries were fighting so hard to have a good process so that, you know, this 100 billion is not just something from the air. It's based on the needs of developing countries. They didn't even want to have a proper process to talk about that. So it was big, big fight. So we had small, small gains. Oh, okay, there is a process now, which is a little bit better than just a talk shop or a workshop or a seminar. So big gain for us. I mean, it's ridiculous because it's really no numbers on the table. Then the one final point, which was really a very important piece, was loss and damage. Many countries, particularly for those of the islands and even our own country, we have to pay attention to this concept of loss and damage, which basically means you cannot adapt to climate change anymore. Adaptation means you can adjust. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have too much of floods, how do you adapt and take action so that, you know, the next time a flood happens, you are able to adapt to that. But we are still far away from adaptation in real terms. But loss and damage is beyond adaptation. Comes as hurricane, your entire economy is wiped out, particularly for the islands. Or what we saw in Philippines, you know, Typhoon Haiyan, you know, 5,000 people and devastation. Your whole economy is wiped out. So the developing world was asking for money to at least have finance associated with loss and damage. And the US, it was a super red line for them. Super red line means it will not cross. It said, no way, no way, no way will we agree to linking finance with loss and damage. And so you had in the decision to have a dialogue, to talk about finance and loss and damage. It's pathetic. Really pathetic. So this was a major letdown, and this was really because of the United States.
So can we talk about the role of the US? I mean, you know, under the Trump presidency, there was a lot of hand-wringing about, you know, not participating in the Paris Accords. Now that it's under the Biden administration, there was hope for some change. And I'm just wondering, with US at the negotiating table, how do you negotiate with a country of that size and that superpower? Particularly if I'm wondering if, you know, the people who attend part of the delegation may also have other vested interests, may also may not want certain lines to be crossed. How was that? I mean, did the US play a conducive role to negotiating, or was that what did they put up roadblocks along the way for negotiating?
Yeah, it was major roadblocks. Actually, if you look at the final outcome, a lot of it was actually biased in favor of the United States. So, like I said, no progress on loss and damage finance, no progress on real finance discussions. So there were roadblocks everywhere. But I think the most important thing, Melissa, is that this whole pretense, not only of the U.S., the U.S. came, in fact, Biden, before coming to the COP, actually was asking OPEC to pump more oil because of energy prices, which are really getting high. So you see the duplicity. You ask OPEC to come and pump more oil so that energy prices go low, and you come to the COP and then you pretend as if you are a champion of climate change. And even the whole Western world and the hypocrisy of it, you know, this whole net zero by 2050.
Right.
And then they launched the carbon markets. The one outcome which was actually a big thing in Glasgow was this thing called Article 6, which is about launching of the carbon markets. What this means is that the developed world will continue to emit carbon, but they will pay the developing world to offset the carbon so that we plant the trees and we have our forests and we have the oceans to sequester the carbon. So that's what they were. That's what the big game plan was. So first, their targets for 2050 is too little, too late. It's too late. We don't have any more carbon budget left to limit the temperature rise to 1.5, because we have to go to rapid emissions reductions within this decade. So with a 2050 target of net zero for rich world, the carbon budget would be exhausted, which means we will breach the 1.5 already. So to come there and talk about net zero by 2050, and that's why I said for the 2 years, the UK presidency was pushing this as if this is going to be the savior of the planet. Now, that's why I say it's a charade, because for people who don't know the details, you really believe that they're going to save the planet. But I tell you, this is really the biggest, I use the term fraud actually in public in Glasgow at a press conference. I said, this is a fraud. It will not deliver on limiting the temperature rise that's needed, shifting the responsibility to the developing countries by and large, no financial resources for the scale that is needed, and using the carbon markets to actually do a lot of that offsetting in our forests and in our oceans. I mean, this is right. Like, this is really a whole narrative which is really unjust and immoral, to say the least.
All right. Mina, when you talk about, it being a fraud and a charade, and I'm just wondering, I mean, you go to these conferences to the every year to global climate talks, and every year, of course, there will be roadblocks and there'll be tough negotiations and progress and stalemates. But where do you see progress happening? I'm just wondering, I mean, you said there were small gains, right? Some small wins. Do you see a progress happening, or are you, pessimistic that this will get resolved on a global stage?
Well, at the end of the day, I think that, I think we need to, all countries have to do more, right? So particularly, the rich will continue to not do the rapid emission reductions they need to do. So we have to prevent them from shifting that. So much of us, what we call the climate justice movements, we were exposing. We were saying how duplicitous the North was and how they were not really, while they talk about ambition, while condemning China and India for coal, they are rapidly expanding their fossil fuel expansion. So we went public with all this there. And you saw the youth with Greta Thunberg and all that. I mean, they see through this duplicity. So we work a lot with those youth movements. But on the why do we keep going and why do we keep engaged? Because this is the only agreement. This is a global problem. It's not a national problem. Everybody needs to be there. And for the developing world, particularly those who need the money, the international cooperation is in enhancing finance. There is a green climate fund. We are pushing for more money to come to the green climate fund. For countries like Malaysia, where we have rich forests and we are always fighting with the states to protect the forest. So we are saying, please keep your forest, but get the money through the international resources so that you can keep your forest intact. So that has to continue. And we do need massive scales of technology for the renewables, for the decarbonizing, for the adaptation, and for the loss and damage we all have to do. So
the work must continue.
The work must continue.
Even though it's hard, right?
It's for hard, sure. Yeah. So even if you have a thing like there's going to be a work program, we grapple at that. We take that, make it work, make the developed countries accountable, push. We have to keep pushing it, keep pressurizing.
You know, what's next? So I know that the next COP is going to be in Egypt. Will that shift things? Because, again, you know, it's not it's a developing country. Perhaps there will be more focus on the issues around the developing world. Do you see, how do we keep the momentum going until we reach COP27 in Egypt?
Yeah, no, COP27 is in Egypt and COP28 is in the United Arab Emirates. So two developing countries in a row. I think Egypt has already made it a priority for adaptation and finance. These are two very important aspects, including loss and damage. So it's very important for them. For the developed world, it's always about mitigation, but it's much more about developing world doing much of the mitigation by transferring a lot of the responsibility. But Egypt will certainly make sure, because even in Glasgow, they were leading in a lot of the discussions on finance. They were, the minister from Egypt actually was having bilaterals and with all the countries together and pushing the envelope for mm-hmm. finance. So we certainly hope that Egypt will actually rebalance much of the you know, needs of developing countries and their right. issues of concern.
Mina, thank you so much for speaking with me today, and thank you for your work and for bringing a sense of urgency to the table when it comes to the need to act for climate change. Thank you, Mina, for your time. That was my conversation with Mina Rahman, president of Sahabat Ala Malaysia, and that wraps up this episode of Consider This. Thank you so much for watching the show. I'm Melissa Idris. I'll see you same time tomorrow.